coming for this week's seminar. Today we have Dilip Mukherjee from Boston University, and he's going to present a paper about decentralized targeting of agricultural credit, private versus political intermediaries. So,
okay, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and meet you all. I'm sure. Okay. Yeah.
It's the first time I'm visiting WIDER, first time in Finland, so I'm enjoying it very much. This is joint work, colleagues from Pushkar Mitra is in Monash University, Sundar Mitra in ISI Calcutta in India, and Sujata Visaria is in Hong Kong. I believe this is, I'm supposed to speak for 45 minutes, so maybe I suggest, I take questions, but clarifying questions as I go along, and then maybe the last 15 minutes you can have a more critical question. So in terms of background, there's been significant trend in the delivery of development programs to delegate, to decentralize, and mainly to local governments. And the World Development Report 2004 echoed the hope and the expectation that this would improve information, the use of information, and boost accountability of providers. But now, even then, even the early literature on decentralization before it actually happened expressed concerns that this is not a panacea. There are pros and cons. And local governments, for instance, may be captured by community elites. And or they may behave clientelistically, targeting benefits to swing voters rather than based on merit or need. And in particular, let me recommend an excellent monograph by Ghazala Mansouri and Biju Rao from the World Bank, reviewing this literature. I think this is 2013, but by then there were at least 500 papers on the topic, and they did really excellent job of putting it together. But that's the main theme, that the effects are highly heterogeneous. So this raises a very important policy question. Well, there are many different ways of decentralizing. Maybe we have to think about the design of decentralization to sort of get more of the pros and minimize the cons. And so this project is a step in that direction, where we are thinking of, well, instead of decentralizing to local governments, which are subject to some of these problems, maybe we consider alternatives to governments, to local governments. For instance, private intermediaries, non-profit organizations, or some kind of community management. But this paper is going to focus on private intermediaries, which is a bit of a new idea. And so I'm going to spend some time explaining why, in the context that we look at, this is quite natural. So our context is a microcredit program in India for smallholder farmers, designed to facilitate the financing of high-value cash crops. And in the state that we are looking at, which is West Bengal in eastern India, the most valuable cash crop in terms of, I'll show you some numbers, in terms of incomes per acre, is at least three times as high as the next most important crop, which is rice. So that is potato. So a lot of the emphasis is going to be on providing loans in a way that facilitate the use of the loans in financing potato cultivation, and allowing poor farmers to expand their cultivation of potato. And I should mention that microcredit, I mean, this is really a microcredit program. Traditional microcredit in the form of group loans turn out to have virtually no effect on agricultural financing because of the severe restrictions imposed on the way microcredit is delivered. So this is an attempt to design a completely different approach which is more borrower friendly and lifts a lot of the traditional restrictions of microcredit. And traditional microcredit, as you know, was based on group loans, on self-forming groups. So you rely on some kind of information within the community about who's a productive farmer, who's a reliable borrower. The idea being that that kind of knowledge exists within the community. And good farmers will team up with good farmers because they're jointly liable for each other's loans. So the idea is to tap into local information that's not available to an external lender. But that's not the only source of local information about productivity and reliability. We are talking about farming, we are talking about borrowing and lending. So who is a reliable borrower? Who is a good farmer? Well, who are the people who deal with farmers? So in the private market, it's local traders and local lenders. So they are also a repository of local information. So this paper is going to develop the idea, how about using them as some kind of commission agent? So the notion is that a trader who's been operating in the village for some time, having developed substantial experience in terms of who is a farmer who's likely to make good use of a loan and who is reliable in terms of repaying loans. So they have this information. So how do we get them to reveal it? We have to incentivize them appropriately. And of course, this could be misused in all kinds of ways. There could be incentives for the private trader to use this to expand their, but if they have some kind of market power, they could be prone to bribes, they could be inclined to recommend their nephew. So cronyism, corruption, all of that is quite likely, so such problems have to be avoided. So what we did, quite aware of these problems, is to design a program. So first approach is we got away from group loans, because a lot of the problems financing agriculture comes from the fact that microcredit was designed to minimize the taking of risks. And your peers, who are your group members, they are liable if your crop fails. And so they have severe incentives to prevent you from financing agriculture. The other problem is, of course, the traditional group loans had to be repaid very frequently. Once a week or once every 2 weeks, and agriculture, typically it's kind of you plant the crop and then you wait 10 weeks, 12 weeks, and then the harvest appears. So you simply cannot continue repaying the loan in the interim when you don't have the revenues. So we decided to break away from the group and offer individual liability loans. We're going to be intermediated by a local agent. And we selected two potato growing districts in West Bengal. And there were 48 villages that were allocated randomly to one of two treatments. One is where a private trader lender was chosen randomly from a list of established business people. And this was going to be compared with where the agent choice was delegated to the local government. Okay, so it's really comparing two methods of intermediation, one going through the local government, selection based on the local government, and the other based on the private trader. What's the role of the agent in the program? The primary role is selection. So the agent, once appointed, is asked to recommend 30 borrowers from a village. Typically these villages have something like 300 to 400 households, of whom about 200 are farmers. So they're selecting from 200 eligible households, and we put a restriction, again to prevent cronyism and corruption, that this is not, this credit should not be siphoned off by wealthy farmers. So the recommended borrowers should own no more than 1.5 acres of cultivable land. And of the 30 recommended, 10, for reasons I'll explain in due course, 10 would be chosen by lottery to actually receive the offer of a subsidized loan. Now, that is the end of the formal role of the agent. So the interaction actually took just a couple of hours. You know, we typically would go into a village, draw up a list based on sort of focus group discussions, and we just talk to people in the village, you know, who are the established traders in the village, satisfying the criterion that they have at least say 50 clients, they've been operating for at least 3 years, they have a good reputation within the village. And you get a list of about 8 or 9 such traders. We just draw one randomly, approach them, explain to them, this is the deal, are you willing to do it? And we're going to explain the incentive for the agents to say yes. We give them a commission, which is 75% of the interest paid by the borrowers they recommend. Okay, so this is the main sort of carrot, getting them to recommend people who are more likely to repay the loans. Okay. Plus, there's a stick. So they also have to post a deposit for each borrower that they recommend, which is going to be forfeited if the borrower defaults. But it's a fairly modest deposit. The agents would, you know, typically the first agent we approached in all cases accepted, this is a good deal. And they say, come back in 3 hours and I'll have the list for you. So that's all that we required from the agent. From that point onwards, the NGO that we were working with, the microfinance institution, took on the task of approaching the selected borrowers, offering them the loan, and then all the transactions was between the MFI that was working with us and the households. Of course, the agent, you know, is a member of the community, continues to deal with them, and so you might expect there would be some kind of informal impact on informal interactions. And that we'll try and sort of tease out from the analysis. Now, so that's basically the program. So the main results. So first I'm going to explain to you the treatment effects that we find. So these are the average treatment effects on potato output of Frail, which is a private intermediary, 26%. Potato profits of the farmers, 41%. And farm income, so aggregating not just looking at potato, but looking at all crops, a 21% increase in farm income. Pretty successful. Okay, and this is sort of in contrast to the experience of microcredit in general, where the average treatment effect is usually zero, with a lot of heterogeneity. In Grail, we also achieve similar average treatment effects, slightly smaller, 23%, but the effects on potato profit and farm income was pretty much a zero. And the difference in profits and farm income is significant at the 10% level. And the main reason is that, you know, well, if the output was high, but, you know, how come the profits and the income were much lower in Grail? And the reason is that there was a difference on the cost side. Unit costs were lower in Grail by 6%, whereas in Grail they increased slightly. So there was a big gap on productivity. There was a productivity impact. And this difference was significant at 1%. There was also a similar effect on crop prices. The trail recommended borrowers managed to sell their crop the potato crop at a significantly higher price. What about the financial performance of the schemes? They had similar loan repayment rates, 93%, okay, which is pretty much, you know, what group loans achieve. And the trail loans had a higher take-up. So the other thing that, you know, we care about is take-up. And quite often with microcredit, the take-up is much lower, 30%. So our loans being more borrower-friendly achieved much higher rates, okay? But trail had a higher take-up. So essentially the private intermediary scheme worked quite well. The local government scheme didn't really have a significant impact on the incomes of the. So this is the result of the experiment. The question is why? So most of the paper is sort of trying to understand that. So the first question we ask, okay, to what extent can this be explained by different selection patterns? Is it the case that the borrowers that were selected by the trail agent were more productive? Okay. So in order to do that, we have to obtain estimates of productivity. So we combine the experimental design with a semi-structural model that allows us to estimate productivity and compare the selection pattern. So what we do is, once we do that, I'll explain to you briefly how it's done. What we find in that in both TRAIL and GRAIL, the recommended borrowers were indeed more productive than the ones that were not recommended. However, the selection in TRAIL was better. Okay, the TRAIL recommended borrowers were more productive, uniformly, irrespective of how you define it, than the ones. So there was superior selection in TRAIL. However, these selection differences, to our surprise, contributed only a very small, about 8 to 10% of the difference in average treatment effects. And by contrast, 75% of the difference was accounted for by a higher treatment effect conditional on productivity. So just pause for a minute, think about that. You have two different treatments in villages that are only different because they were randomly chosen for application to different treatments. And then with our estimate of ability or productivity of underlying farmers, we are taking two farmers who are, you know, not just in terms of observable characteristics, but also the latent productivity characteristic the same, in two villages which are essentially the same. And in one village, the TRAIL treated farmer is achieving a much higher treatment effect with a loan which has exactly the same features. So you get a substantially bigger impact for exactly the same kind of farmer in the same kind of village. How could this be? You know, what happened? Obviously, there was something else in terms of the engagement, the role of the agent at an informal level. So we develop and test a model of interactions, of informal interactions between the agent and the farmer to explain these differences. And I won't have time to go into the details of the model, but basically what we find is, this is the story that we find. The fact that there exists a trade relationship between the TRAIL agent and the farmer induced a sharing of upside and downside risk, and provided incentives to the agent to help treated farmers with business advice on how to lower costs and how to sell at a better price. The GRAIL agent, by contrast, had no, you know, business. The occupation was different, they were not traders, and their main motivation was to reduce the default risk of selected borrowers. And so they tended to monitor treated farmers. Monitoring, and they focused this on the least productive, the poorest borrowers. And in order to reduce default risk, insisted on cultivation practices that raised costs. So for instance, apply more pesticides because it will reduce the risk of a crop failure. But the risks are not that high. As you can see, they're repaying the loans at a pretty high rate, 93%. So most of the time, you know, the crop failure is not happening, but they end up spending more. Okay, and that kind of wipes out the potential gains from the increased output. So those are the results, and let me just sort of set it in context of the literature on targeting. So there's now a sort of a growing literature on trying to utilize local community information to improve the targeting of services. So there's a whole bunch of papers here where the idea is that if there's some kind of homophily at a social level, okay, the same caste or the same ethnicity between an intermediary, okay, or the service officer or some kind of community agent and the subjects, the fact that there is sort of better information and, you know, the existence of social relationships, for instance, creates a certain accountability. And you so these are a bunch of papers that show that sort of using community agents improves selection. Now, what is the analog of sort of using community information in this microcredit context? Most of these papers are about, let's say, the diffusion of new technologies in agriculture or the take-up of public health insurance programs. This is in the context of in microcredit. Our previous paper, which is already published, compare TRAIL with the group-based microcredit. And their selection differences were indeed significant. So the trail, the private agent actually did substantially better than this kind of community monitoring. This paper also, so we find in this paper, we are now not contrasting sort of self-forming groups, but rather selection by a local government. And we are finding that the private trader-based selection is doing better. But this selection difference turns out to play a relatively unsubstantial role here. So I think what's new in this paper is this idea that it's not just selection. There's also where we need to understand informal interactions within the community. And treatments can themselves have an impact on those interactions. There's also sort of a related literature on networks. Again, this is mostly in the context of trying to promote the take-up of new products, new technologies. So Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo et al., a series of papers on the diffusion of microfinance or the diffusion of new technologies, and Arun Chandrasekhar, et cetera, where they go into villages, they actually try to map the entire network, a social network within a village, and then use sort of measures of network centrality to identify central nodes in the network, and then go through that particular sort of person as an intermediary to promote take-up and diffusion. But when you think about it, apart from the fact that mapping an entire village network is extremely time-consuming, resource-intensive, there's also a question of when you think about, you know, think about a village network, there are many networks. Which network? Okay, there are social networks, there are economic networks, there are political networks. So in a way, what we are doing here is looking at two different networks, a political network and an economic network, and then selecting between the nodal points of those two respective networks. And our findings also indicate, I mean, in that network literature, there's essentially a focus on the sort of the architecture of the network, who's linked with whom. And I think it misses what we find more important here, which is it's not just who's linked to whom that matters, but the treatments themselves can affect those interactions. There are strategic incentives, so it's not just the existence of a link, but the nature of the link changes. Okay, so that's by way of sort of general introduction, and if you want to switch off or go to sleep or walk out, you're most welcome. That's the sort of executive summary. And for those of you who want to stay, so this is kind of the roadmap. I'll talk about the context and the design, more detail, and then the empirical results on the average treatment effects, how we deal with selection and how important selection is, and then finally, how do we explain the differences in the conditional treatment effects. But let me pause now for any questions.
The incentives, they were the same for the government as for the private.
The formal state. Incentives, yes. Exactly the same commission, it's the same deposits. Yes.
Right. And what's the kind of sums of money which you're dealing with?
I'll explain that in a minute. Okay, let me get into that then. So the focus is on potatoes, the leading cash crop, and we have two potato growing districts, Hooghly and West Medinipur. And we select 24 villages in each for each treatment across the two districts. The experiment lasted 8 4-month cycles. The loans were 4-month loans and started in 2010, went till the summer of 2013. I should mention that this experiment went longer. Usually most experiments are 1.5 years. This is a 3-year experiment. Also, our surveys were carried out 3 times a year, okay, instead of just a baseline and an endline. And that was very important, especially when you are looking at farming. There's a lot that's happening. And so for instance, potato is harvested typically in March, but then it's sold throughout the year. You really have to keep track of, because a lot of them are selling, let's say, half the potato at the time of the harvest, but the other half they're sort of holding on and selling depending on the conditions of the market. And you have to keep going back and asking them, okay, of the potatoes that you didn't sell at the time of the harvest, did you sell any? And sometimes the payment for those transactions are staggered. They don't get the payment all at once for a particular sale because of all kinds of liquidity problems in the supply chain. So there's a first part payment at the time of the transaction, but then there is a later settling up and just taking care of all the accounts and so on, unless you ask them repeatedly and ensure consistency in answers between different rounds, you don't get good data. We have a sample of, I'll explain the composition of the sample, but 50 households per village in each cycle. And the 50 is broken down into the 10 that were treated, that were selected from amongst those recommended. Then, recall, 30 were recommended, 10 were randomly selected. So 20 were unlucky in the lottery. Okay, they were recommended but not selected in the lottery. Of that 20, we select 10 randomly. Okay, and we call that, that's the first control group, control one. And then of the ones that were not recommended, okay, out of the, okay, we pick up 30 randomly. Okay, that's the second control group. And the reason we do it in this way is that these were recommended, and at the time of the recommendation, the agent didn't know who was going to be selected for treatment. So they are sort of, for all practical purposes, similar. Okay? They differ only because these 10 were lucky to be selected in the lottery to actually receive the loan. So in terms of trying to estimate selection, okay, there is no sort of difference between these two groups. So the difference of outcomes between these two groups is the pure treatment effect of the loan, controlling for unobserved type. The difference between these people, neither of these two groups got the loan. Neither of the two control groups got the loan. But these were recommended and these were not. Okay, so the difference between these two is the pure selection effect. So this way, this design, you can separate selection from treatment effects. Okay, now the features of the loan. The average interest rate in the informal market is about 25%. It ranges from 21 to 29%. Those are the 10th and the 19th percentile. So we set the interest rate on our loans below, you know, the 10th percentile, so at 18% annual percentage rate. The loans were 4-month duration, so this is the probably the most significant departure from microcredit. It's a very flexible loan, okay? We just give the loans at the time of the harvest. We find out when the crop is being harvested in each village, and we make sure to give the loans 2 weeks before they plant. And then we go show up after the crop has been harvested. We go a week or two after they harvest. Give them time to sell the crop. So the timing of the loans coincides with the potato crop cycle. Individual liability, so we got rid of groups. We also got rid of all the stuff that the borrowers hate about traditional microcredit. They don't like the group meetings. They don't like the savings requirements, okay? All the blah, blah, blah about citizenship and, you know, empowerment and all of that. I mean, you know, they're fed up. They waste half a day every week in these meetings. And then the other problem is that in order to sort of inculcate, you know, habit of financial inclusion, you know, traditional microcredit insists on everybody opening a bank account and all the money going through a bank account. But, you know, the bank typically is 8 kilometers away. This takes them 3 hours to get to the bank. Once they get to the bank, they're not treated well in the bank, okay? I mean, the uniformed guard outside the bank says, who are you? Go away, you know, don't enter this bank. So they don't even know how to do transactions in the bank, and so they need to go with somebody in the village who takes them, and then they have to give a cut to that person. It's a big hassle for them. What we did is doorstep service, okay? So our microfinance institution goes to their homes, okay, and then makes them the loan offer at home. And even when you offer the money and then when you want to pick up the repayment, you know, after the harvest, again, MFI official goes to their homes. So it's extremely convenient for them. And I really believe this is very important in terms of promoting financial inclusion. And I've talked to many officials in the Indian government trying to get them to think about doorstep banking, or at least mobile vans that go from village to village instead of requiring villagers to go to the neighboring town, which is really quite onerous. But of course, you know, those guys say, no, the people have to come to us. I mean, the whole culture of banking is going to change if we have to go to their house. So there were eight four-month cycles. And we started with small. So here's the scale of the loans. We started with small loans. 2,000 rupees is about $40 US at that time. But there's fast growth of credit access. So to provide strong incentives to the borrowers to repay the loans, we said that we will expand the size of the loan that you are eligible for in the next cycle at 133% of what you repay in the current one. So it grew very fast, and it went to almost, I think they were eligible, borrowers who were repaying were eligible for something like 9,000 rupees. And most of them were not utilizing the full credit limit towards the end. And we had to sort of offer some grace in case they fell behind on their payments, but if they fell behind by more than 50% of the amount due at any point, then we said you've defaulted, they would be terminated at that point, and in fact the agent would also have to forfeit the deposit in that situation. And the last other feature, which I think is very important for promoting agricultural finance, we provided partial insurance against village-level potato price and yield risk. So we would carry out surveys at the harvest time about what the price is and what the yield was in that particular year. And if it was less than 20% of the moving average for the last 3 years, we forgave a corresponding proportion of the loan. This, it turned out, had a major impact in our pilot in terms of the take-up. So these loans were very borrower-friendly, which, you know, explains why the take-up was so much higher. And by the way, you know, whenever I talked at various, you know, places like IPA and so on, people who had a lot of experience in microfinance, and I told them that we were going in with loans with this feature, you know, they all said, oh, this money is not ever coming back. Okay? And you're dreaming if you think that this money is going to get repaid. But of course, you know, it turned out that it's come back. Okay. So that's, let me pause here for any questions about the scheme, okay, before I go into the details of the results.
So how volatile will the potato price is season to season? Quite
it is typically very volatile, but those were good years. Good years, I mean, one was really very good, but the other two were kind of average, but they were not bad years. So yeah, in that sense, I mean, Udry and Rosenzweig have this paper about, you know, one of the problems, external validity of controlled experiments is that they usually for a year or two and, you know, you don't incorporate, you know, the effects of what it would be if the crop price was something else in some other year. So I think that is a point well taken. And that, yeah, so to that extent, these results have to be conditioned, you know, with that qualification that these were pretty good years. That's true. Yeah. Picked, yes, that's right. The same borrower, we kept with the same borrower for 3 years.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
The one thing I'm wondering, but I think you already showed something for prices, is there kind of space for some kind of extortionary relationship between the trader and the farmer in the end if it's a repeated game?
That's right. Yes, so the story at the end is going to be that. Yeah, so there's a lot of concern about what this would do to the interaction between the farmer and the trader, and also whether these benefits would be somehow siphoned off by the trader from the farmer.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. The previous paper that we wrote went into it. We actually asked farmers for details of all kinds of transactions, including potato and all other commodities, all inputs they buy, all outputs they sell, who they sell to, who they buy from, what prices, and so on. And if, I mean, you would expect that, you know, if you want to siphon it off, you do it by, for instance, manipulating prices in these transactions. So we looked for whether, for commodities that you're selling to the trader, whether the price is systematically different between the treated farmers and the controlled one farmers, for instance. We found that was not the case. If anything, it was going the other way. The farmers that were treated were getting a better price. So we found, we looked for, look at 40 different commodity transactions, and we simply did not find any evidence of that.
But that basically also is probably, is there more than one trader in
that is true.
So
it, these are fairly competitive settings.
Okay.
Yes, so yes, that's right. Yeah, we've looked at the sort of potato markets. I have a series of papers on how the potato supply chain and the marketing and all of that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, each village has about 8 or 9 traders.
Mm-hmm.
The Herfindahl index for the concentration, pretty low. It looks like a pretty competitive market. There is not much, implicit bonding or even implicit contracting. It's a pretty fluid and competitive market. And that's perhaps
that's
that exactly. That's right. At the same time, people are selling to the same trader repeatedly over time, but they're not bound to. So the fact that they do sell repeatedly to the same trader may just reflect issue of convenience, who you know, who's close by, and so forth. And indeed, that is going to be a driving force for the results at the end. It's really the trader's incentive to increase. It turns out the main source of profit for the traders is that they are middlemen in the potato trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the margins that they earn are pretty substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a strong incentive to increase the potato business.
Mm-hmm.
And on credit, actually, it's fairly competitive.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you some numbers here. So they're really making money on the potato.
Mm-hmm.
And our loans allowed the farmers to expand their cultivation and sale of potato.
Mm-hmm.
And that was essentially the benefit to the agent. And that's why the agent had an incentive to recommend the more productive farmers and help them. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how much of the loan they were taking was actually invested in their production? Like
yes, I'll show you. I'll show you some details. Yeah. Yes,
okay.
Quite often. But again, it's a pretty competitive market. They don't. So typically, in fact, I think between the trader and the farmers in question, something like 7 to 8% were selling to this particular trader. They could be selling to other traders. So this is gives you some idea of the household characteristics here. This is for the set of eligible. This is the eligible population, which is those who own no more than 1.5 acres of cultivable land. Only 40% the household has more than primary schooling education. 44% are farmers, the principal occupation. Another 34% are unskilled labor working on the labor market. And so add this up, about 80% of the sample is either in farming or working in the agricultural labor market. So they're pretty poor people. The average holding of land, of cultivable land, is about 0.5 acre. And 1 out of 8 has a motorized vehicle. And about 1/2 of them have a bank account. So this is, again, if you just went through the banks, you wouldn't reach more than 1/2 of them.
Mm-hmm.
These are the three principal crops, sesame, paddy, and potatoes, the three principal cash crops. And the bottom line here, the value added per acre in potatoes is about 3 times as high as it is in sesame and paddy. Okay. But it is also a riskier crop. The potato price fluctuates a lot from year to year. So it's a high risk, high mean value crop. And typically when you go to these districts and you sort of ask people, or ask poor people, what is the way out of poverty here? And more often than not, they'll tell you potato. And the middleman margins, however, are pretty high. And in a separate paper, we estimated these middleman margins, and turns out to be at least 30 to 40% of the wholesale price. So the return to the middleman is almost as high as the gross price received by the farmer. Okay. and the remaining 30% is transport and distribute storage costs. This is the baseline details of credit. Yes.
No, 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
45.
Ah, really?
Okay.
All right. Let me. I'll have to really speed up then. So 2 out of 3 loans are from trader lenders, and they're paying an interest rate of 25%. The average interest rate of 25%, but they're not collateralized. 2% of loans are from family and friends. Microfinance penetration was very low; it's about 2%. And then you have cooperatives and banks offering lower interest rates of 16% and 12%. Okay, but these are collateralized, and it's precisely because of the collateral requirements that most of these farmers cannot obtain access to the cheaper loans. And lenders, so we did a separate survey of the lenders trying to figure out their costs of capital, and their cost of capital is about 20% to 24%. So when you see the average interest rate of about 25%, they're not making money on the credit. Agent characteristics, the Grail agent is more likely to be a farmer, much less likely to be a business person, 20% as against 96% of the Grail agent, as against the Trail agent, are business people. Education and wealth is roughly similar, but the Grail agent is much more likely to be a member of the main political party, or a member of an important village society, or a member of the local government, okay, unlike the Trail agent. And this is a survey at the baseline of agent-farmer relationships. The farmers are much more likely to have an economic, significant economic relationship with the Trail agent than with the Grail agent. In terms of caste and religion similarity, is greater in the case of Grail. And in terms of the existence of social relationships, it was pretty high in both cases, above 90%, and not so dissimilar. Okay, so this is, again, this is the regression specification, and as I mentioned, we have a treatment group and control one and then control two. So the difference between control two and control one, which is the beta 3 minus beta 1, that's a selection effect. And beta 2 minus beta 3 is sort of the difference between the treatment and the control. And then we have controls for a bunch of household, observable household characteristics. So given that my time is almost up, let me just zoom, show you some of the average treatment effects. So this is the amount on all borrowing that is used for agricultural purposes, very similar between Grail and Trail. One concern could be that they could be using these loans to reduce their informal borrowing, because the informal borrowing is more expensive, but they didn't do that. So this is evidence that they were indeed credit constrained. So they kept their informal loans at the level that they used to, and then used this for more agricultural finance. And effects on potato acreage, significantly positive in both. Potato output also increases a little bit more in Trail, but significant in both. But then when you look at potato value added, which excludes the cost of family labor, significantly positive and high in Trail, but not in Grail. This is indistinguishable from zero. And the same is true if you look at all crops. So this is the main result that I explained to you earlier. The take-up and the default rates were higher in Trail. And the default rates were about the same. So I'm out of time here. So again, I guess there's no trying to explain how we estimated underlying productivity. The unobserved heterogeneity is very significant. So the interquartile range for productivity is about, you know, the order of 50% to 100% variation. Okay, that's the interquartile, just between the 75th and the 25th percentile. If you try and correlate this with observable characteristics, you can explain at most 20%, even with lasso-based techniques. So 80% of it is unobserved heterogeneity. This is why sort of tapping community information is very important, because people in the community know something that you don't. Okay, 80% of that variation is known in the community, but not otherwise. And then these are comparing the productivity distribution within TRAIL between the recommended and the non-recommended. And you see that you get first order stochastic dominance. You get superior productivity amongst those recommended than not recommended. But it's true, equally true in both TRAIL and GRAIL. But then when you compare the selected in TRAIL with GRAIL, the TRAIL selection was better. Again, in the sense of first order stochastic dominance.
Can I ask, what's the productivity indicator? What's productivity?
Yeah, that, well, I have to speed up there.
Yeah.
Okay, so the underlying model is that there is something TFP. It's a TFP measure. It's a ratio of TFP to unit costs of production. So the simple model that's underlying it is that farmers vary in a one-dimensional ability, and higher ability farmers have higher TFP and lower unit costs. And then effectively what you can do is, because we have panel data, we can extract from the fixed effects, the farmer fixed effects in the panel data using either the scale of cultivation or the output, we can back out a measure of ability. And that's what I'm referring to here. You can also calculate the rate of return. And you know, it maps one-to-one with the rate of return. I'm really out of time here, so I guess let me stop here. Let me just go directly. One other part which may be of interest to people interested in sort of plantalism, which is the theme of the workshop on Friday, we also looked at whether the selection in GRAIL was partly due to plantalistic motives. And since this is an experiment, you know, some lot of difficult endogeneity problems are overcome by the randomized design. And so one question was, you know, is there evidence that the GRAIL agent was selecting on the basis of political motives? So if he was trying to behave clientelistically, he'd try and give it to people whose vote would switch. So we actually conducted a straw poll at the end of the experiment and gave them pieces of ballot paper with marks of different political parties that are important in the local area. And then they just, you know, just like any election, then they select a poll, support it, and put it into a ballot box. And we use that data to see if you can see, where is that? Oh, I'm sorry, this is the wrong file. It's at the very end, here. So the likelihood of somebody who receives a loan switching his vote to the political incumbent from some other party, there's an 8% effect on the voting. This appears only in GRAIL but not in TRAIL. And then when you break it down into, so we classify borrowers into three groups depending on ability. So bin one is the lowest ability group, and this effect is concentrated. There's a 13% effect for the poorest borrowers. Okay, which is consistent with the theory of political clientelism, because clientelism, sort of, you want to buy votes, then you buy them where they're cheapest to, and you know, poorer people are willing to sell their vote for less. So typically clientelism tends to sort of pile up at the bottom end, and that's exactly what we find. Okay, so anyway, this is the summary. Let me conclude here. So we have higher average treatment effects on potato and farm income in TRAIL, but not in GRAIL. There's evidence of better selection, but most of it is driven not by selection, but by differences in conditional treatment effects, especially on unit costs, suggests important role of informal interaction. And so the better performance of TRAIL, both with respect to selection and agent engagement, is explained by the absence of political motives and better aligned economic incentives in this situation. So they were more in the nature of equity holders rather than debt holders. The GRAIL agent was more of a debt holder. I was bearing the downside risk, but not enjoying any of the benefits on the upside. And so it's just too conservative, and forcing these people to adopt costly ways of reducing the likelihood of default. Okay, let me stop here.
Thank you very much. We made it for question would be that, you know, so male agents are targeting poorer voters for planning this voting, but after the elections, what would be the incentive? For the next election 5 years away, let's say,
no, this election happened in 2010. And you know, there was assembly, I mean, everybody was gearing up for the assembly elections in 2011. And so that, and you know that there was, you know, severe contestation between the left front and the Trinamool Congress. The left front had been dominant in West Bengal politics for 35 years. They had won 7 successive elections, but their vote share was sort of constantly going down, and they were in risk of losing, and in fact, they lost their majority in 2011 for the first time. And that was in the state assembly election. And then the panchayat election, the local government election, was in 2013. So these two important elections were coming up, and the selection was actually done in 2010. So, and we carried out this poll in 2013 at the end of, anyway, so it does reflect whatever incentives the parties, the incumbent parties had on the eve of the election.
The big difference in the value added is so striking.
Yeah.
How do you control for the price effects in that? Because you're emphasizing the cost.
No, the price is an outcome. So basically the story on prices is similar. The effect on price is not statistically significant, but it is quantitatively quite significant.
But I'm wondering if the trail farmers can sell when the prices are higher.
Exactly.
They have a different price, they have a different marketing strategy.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. The thing is, we didn't, the effects on costs were statistically significant and quantitatively significant. The crop price effects were quantitatively significant but noisier. And so that's why we didn't lay that much emphasis on the crop price. But yes, that's exactly the direction it goes. And the traders are providing advice, we believe. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going on. So even we have one slide which is about, we ask farmers about interactions they've had with the agent. This is at the end of each cycle. So how many interactions have you had with so-and-so, you know, bunch of people, and then the agent is one of them in the last 3 days? So this is the number of interactions they've had with the agent, their particular agent. And what you see in grail is that the bin one, the lowest, you know, the least productive types, the grail agent is spending a lot of time with them. Okay, because that's where the default risks are highest. Whereas with the trail agent, it's exactly the opposite. Okay, he's actually, so our interpretation is that this is monitoring and this is help. And the trail agent is sort of channeling time towards the people for whom giving advice would have the biggest effect, you know, on the trader's own profit, you know, the expected output implications. So it's sort of increasing in ability in trail, but the interaction is decreasing in ability. And in fact, the purpose of this is to reduce the default risk. So this is the typical pattern of informal interest rates, which, given the nature of the credit market, you see that the lowest productivity people pay the highest interest rate, about 21% compared to 15 or 16%. So this reflects differential default risk. So these people have the largest default risk. But then on our loans, you see for trail, you have a similar pattern of decreasing default rates, okay, across the three bins. But in grail, you know, these guys default much less, okay, because of that intensive monitoring.
First of all, it's funny that the lower two bins, there's nothing, right? It's more productive than even they will see anything. But so it's, if this is driving it, then basically the initial choice, and then working with this top bin, but what has helped? Do like they do they consult on the type of seed to use or on the timing or?
It's very hard for us to tell. Yeah. But we break it down between the now and the interaction. We ask them, what exactly are you talking about? And we're looking at cultivation, discussions of cultivation, discussions of buying and selling activities, and discussion of loans. So most of it is concentrated in the second category, buying and selling. So that's why we think it's sort of business advice, and in particular, when to sell the crop, for instance, whether to hold, whether to sell now, where to buy the input, where to what brand to buy. So one of the things in potato that is very uncertain is apparently the seed, which comes from a different state, and there's a particular high quality variety, and there's a lot of sort of, you have rival companies that will try and sort of masquerade as the well-known brand. Okay, so the traders have better ability to identify, you know, the authentic brand as against the inauthentic one. And so there's all that kind of advice that we are guessing is what's going on. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, so I think what this tells you is that, you know, there may be contexts where private traders don't play as much of a role in, let's say, potato marketing. So we were trying to do a follow-up experiment in a different state, Maharashtra. And there we interviewed farmers and traders. There the farmers were selling the crop directly in the wholesale market rather than through the traders as middlemen. So, you know, so the success of this scheme would, you know, most likely not extend in the Maharashtra context for that particular reason. And yes, so you're right. If you're talking about health services, it's not clear that the private trader has any sort of information advantage with respect to health services. So yes, this is very specific to this particular intervention. But talking about, you know, at least in this context, the importance of acumen or experience, 20% of the GRAIL agents are also traders. So we looked what the difference was between a GRAIL agent who was a trader and a trail agent who was a trader. And the GRAIL agent who is a trader is also subject to political pressure from the party. And it turns out that they don't behave that dissimilarly from the other GRAIL agents who are not traders. So somehow, you know, acumen, I thought, was trumped by the political motive. In particular, selecting people at the bottom end. So part of the clientelistic motive, the GRAIL agent ended up selecting more poor people. So the bottom bin was actually much larger in GRAIL. And that was kind of, and you can see that they're spending most of their time having recommended these sort of people who have no prior experience cultivating potato, but they've always been dreaming of growing potato. They use this scheme, get them into potato, but then they're worried that they're not going to be able to repay the loan. So they end up spending a lot of time counseling them and making sure that they don't take any risks. And the same was true for the GRAIL agents who were traders. So we looked at the effectiveness. Again, the sample is getting smaller and smaller as we are dicing the data. But then we look at the effectiveness of the GRAIL agents who are traders in advising the high productivity farmers. And they're actually pretty similar to the trail agents who are also advising the high productivity. So acumen played a role at the top end, but the political motive, you know, sort of was dominant at the lower end, which, you know, ended up being much more important.
Is it, just to follow up that, is another way of framing it to say that the GRAIL equity oriented was the trail or efficiency oriented?
Yes, yes, yes. That's right. Well, but you know, we have
it doesn't work. They don't,
no, no,
the
thing
overall
is
outcome is not, but their equity, they
the intention
is
exactly, but the outcome, it didn't particularly help those poor guys to move into Potato.
Yeah.